This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey all, welcome back to the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. I'm your host, pharmacist Eric Christensen. Thanks so much for listening today. Always want to remind you guys, definitely go check us out at reallifepharmacology.com. Go sign up for the email list. We let you know when we've got a new podcast and other stuff available. Go check that out, reallifepharmacology.com, and you'll get a free 31-page PDF, kind of a little study guide. On the top 200 drugs. So really a unique resource just to kind of have that highlights really the most important things you're actually going to see in clinical practice. And I also tried to tie in a lot of the things that you're going to see in quizzes and exams throughout your career in taking exams, board exams in relation to pharmacology. So go check that out at reallifepharmacology.com. All right, so let's get into the drug today. Citalopram is what we're going to cover. Brand name of this medication is Celexa. And if you remember, I did more of a generalized overview of SSRIs, but there's really some unique clinical quirks with citalopram that I wanted to kind of nail down and make sure everyone was aware of there. So mechanistically, being an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Essentially, this allows more action and activity and allows serotonin to remain in the synapse and cause more action. And that serotonin is well known to be associated with feelings of happiness and things of that nature. So with that, we anticipate that providing more serotonin will help. Depression is probably the most common indication I see it used for. It's also got indications and evidence to support the use in anxiety, OCD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's lots of different things you may see citalopram used for. Overwhelmingly, I'd say I see it used for depression and anxiety when I do see it in clinical practice. Let's talk about adverse effects a little bit. GI upset, nausea, that can certainly happen with SSRIs in general. It can happen with citalopram. Dry mouth is one that I have seen happen before. Citalopram, so some of the SSRIs are much more sedating or much more activating. I think of citalopram as kind of being a little bit more in the middle of the road, where you may see patients that have a sedating type response, and you may see patients that get an activating type response. So I can't really give you any specific trend there. We just have to monitor patients, make sure they're tolerating it okay. If I had a patient that really struggled with insomnia, let's say, and they were staying up at night, I would definitely look and make sure that medication is being dosed in the day. Same thing with sedation. If it was being dosed early in the morning and the patient said they felt sedated for several hours in the morning, maybe after taking that medication, that might be a patient to do a trial to switch that citalopram to the evening. So again, you want to kind of tailor what you're going to do depending upon the patient response there and if they encounter either of those potential adverse effects. Behavioral changes can happen with any of the SSRIs and citalopram included there. Remember, there is a boxed warning in pediatrics and young adults about an increased risk of suicidal behavior and case reports potentially supporting that. So that's a good education point, but also a good thing to pay attention to, especially early on as we're figuring out if the patient is going to tolerate this medication or not. SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, that can lead to a significant hyponatremia. And in general, citalopram on its own, at least in my experience, I don't know if I've seen too many situations where it's done it on its own, but oftentimes it's patients that maybe have a pre-existing hyponatremia, have other risk factors, maybe they're on other medications like carbamazepine, for example. So usually the significantly low hyponatremias that I've seen have been more associated with patients with numerous risk factors and reasons for hyponatremia, but it is something to look out for. Another one, sexual dysfunction, that's more of a class adverse effect with the SSRIs. I think I talked about that before. We can look to other agents if this is a significant problem. Again, not other SSRIs. We're probably going to look at bupropion or maybe a mirtazapine that may have less risk for that sexual dysfunction adverse effect. All right, so with citalopram, dosing is important. So usual dosage range I've seen is in that 10 to 40 milligram range with a couple of caveats. So the first thing I think of, and this is speaking to my population that I work with mostly, in geriatrics, in patients over the age of 60, according to the manufacturer package insert, the max recommended dose of citalopram is 20 milligrams. So as you could imagine, that gets difficult to try to figure out what to do sometimes if you've got a patient that has done well on a dose and now all of a sudden they're, 60, 65, 70. What do we do? Do we leave them on that 40 milligrams, which maybe technically isn't recommended? Or do we try to do something else? So I guess I want to backtrack a second. I want to talk about the risk, potentially, of higher concentrations of citalopram. So the risk, the biggest risk, is association with QT prolongation and obviously cardiac complications from that, which could be potentially severe and life-threatening if bad enough there. So thinking about that patient that's getting older and they're on 40 milligrams of citalopram, obviously we can think about a trial reduction and trying to taper down on that dose. Now, that may or may not work depending upon the situation, but that's probably a good place to start as we think about deprescribing and making sure patients are at the minimum effective dose. Now, when that's not possible, or patients maybe tried that in the past and they failed miserably, and they, the citalopram is the only antidepressant that works for them, which those situations do happen, and you get, painted into a tough corner. The major thing I would look at here is risk factors for QT prolongation, and looking at an actual EKG to see what that QT interval is. So that can give you a little bit more sense of what's going on with this patient, and are we putting this patient at higher risk by having them on the citalopram? If the QT interval wasn't too bad or in more of a normal range, we're doing okay, and we can probably continue on with that medication. If we're on the higher risk end, if we're approaching, 500 or higher as far as the QT interval goes there, that's definitely a riskier situation. So we've got to think about patients clinically. But again, trial dose reduction we can consider, and EKG and monitoring for QT prolongation risk are probably the two most important strategies that I use in trying to assess what we should do about a patient kind of on a long-term higher dose of citalopram. All right, so that's going to wrap up the first section here. We're going to finish up with drug interactions after a quick break from our sponsor. If you're in the market for pharmacist board certification study materials like MTM, geriatrics, ambulatory care, pharmacotherapy, or the NAPLEX exam, definitely go check out meded101.com/store. You'll find links to all sorts of packages as far as question banks, review courses for those various exams. So go check that out. Support the sponsor where you can help keep this content free and educational for all to enjoy. In addition to that, if you're a healthcare professional just looking to hone your skills, get better at medication therapy, medication management, again, go check out meded101.com/store. We've got Amazon books. We've got links to Audible books. You can get your first Audible book for free, by the way. So, you know, a 6 to 10 hour book on clinical pharmacy. You can go check that out and get those links at meded101.com/store. All right, so let's wrap up on drug interactions. And there are definitely a few important ones that I think about with citalopram specifically. So first off, citalopram is metabolized by a couple of liver enzymes. And primarily the first one I think about is CYP2C19. So if we inhibit CYP2C19, we're potentially going to raise those concentrations, increase risk for adverse effects and QT prolongation and things of that nature. So think about that enzyme. Two classic medications I think of. One is way more common than the other, and that most common medication is omeprazole. There's a lot of people on a generic Prilosec, okay? And it's got some drug interactions, and citalopram is definitely one of those. So it's actually recommended to max out the dose of citalopram to 20 milligrams if the patient is taking omeprazole. Okay, so it's important, again, where you can get put into this clinical judgment situation where, you know, maybe you've got a patient on 30 milligrams of citalopram or 40, and they're on omeprazole as well, and they're doing okay. You know, what do we do? Well, we can certainly monitor that patient. And again, we could consider a trial reduction if they're doing well and things are going okay. So I'm talking about a trial reduction of citalopram. What we can also do is a trial reduction and potentially, hopefully, taper off of omeprazole. In my geriatric patient population, I see that a lot, the overprescribing of PPIs. So make sure that we actually need both drugs, because if we don't, or if we can reduce doses or whatever the case may be, we can lower that risk for QT prolongation and drug interactions there. So cimetidine is another example of a drug that can have some 2C19 inhibition, but by far in clinical practice, omeprazole and citalopram is the most common interaction I probably see there. SSRIs, I did go through those a little bit in the general SSRI category. We've got to remember other drugs that can increase the activity of serotonin. So serotonin syndrome is a risk. So a drug like tramadol, linezolid, TCAs like amitriptyline, MAOIs, an older drug not used very often. But these are all drugs that have serotonergic activity and could increase that risk of serotonin syndrome, particularly in combination with citalopram. Bleed risk, this is always kind of a controversial one and a difficult one for me. Citalopram does and has been reported to have some antiplatelet-type activity, so maybe some blood-thinning effect. How clinically significant that is, I would say, is probably up for debate. Now, if you've got a patient that has significant bleeding history, still having issues, certainly we've got to consider the SSRI as well as any antiplatelets, NSAIDs, anticoagulants, all these medications that can contribute to bleed risk. So it's something I look out for if somebody is really anemic or they're having blood loss or bleeding or bruising. But it's generally not crazy high on my radar as far as risks go. So again, important to keep an eye on it and think about it. But how clinically significant it is in many situations, sometimes it's hard to determine, and it's, you know, really looked at on a case by case basis based upon other medications and what's going on with that patient there. So CYP3A4, in addition to 2C19, could impact concentrations of citalopram and activity of citalopram. So think about some of the classic CYP3A4 inhibitors I've mentioned before. So those can raise concentrations and essentially the effects of citalopram. Now, inducers can potentially lower the effectiveness of citalopram. So just one last kind of drug interaction that I wanted to talk about there. And then, of course, you know, other drugs that prolong the QT interval. I think I talked about several of them in the antipsychotic podcast, but definitely important to take a look at that risk. Monitor EKGs if we do have risk factors for QT prolongation. And I also have an excellent blog post, a guest blog post that was shared with me. To find that blog post, go check out QT Prolongation for Community Pharmacists Quick Guide at meded101.com/blog. You should be able to find it there. A really, really excellent kind of breakdown of things we can look out for and things we can monitor as far as QT prolongation risk and the use of medication. So a quick plug there on that blog post, which I felt was really helpful to kind of simplify things and get us thinking in a more clinical fashion. So definitely go check that out. So I think that's going to wrap it up for today. If you enjoyed the podcast, do me a huge favor and leave a rating and review on iTunes, or share this podcast with colleagues, friends, students, any healthcare professionals that you feel might benefit from learning a little bit more about medications. So I'm going to sign off for today. You can track me down at LinkedIn, Eric Christensen, PharmD, BCPS, BCGP, and shoot me a message there. Feel free to do that. And I'll let you go for today, and thank you so much for listening.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.